Hey, everybody. You know, I was thinking movie theaters would make great supermarkets. High ceilings, wide doors. You just rip out the seats, throw in some freezers, and you're good to go. Because let's face it, nobody's going to movies anymore. Who wants to sit through 4 hours of trailers and take out a mortgage to buy popcorn and soda? Now, there's a better way to get movies and TV shows. I want to tell you about a great website where you'll find thousands of movies and TV shows at incredible prices. It's deepdiscount.com. Everything on the site is discounted. It's great. I just bought 3 movies on it. And they're low, low prices. Click their logo on my website and you'll see what I mean. Just go to paulmercurio.com. It's right on my homepage. And all this month, be sure to look for coupon codes and icons for even more savings on Blu-rays, comedy, and complete TV series too. Look, stop wasting time searching and searching to find your favorites on your cable system. You know how that ends up. Arguments, and then you're in a loveless marriage. All right, that got a little personal, but you know what I mean. Take charge. Go buy it. No more commercials. No more edits. No more bad streams that buffer all the time. Buy the shows you want to watch and own them forever. Pass them down in the will. Why not? At deepdiscount.com, you'll find classics, hard-to-find titles, and new releases, too. Coming out this week, great movie, Molly's Game, based on the true story of Molly Bloom, an Olympic-class skier who ran the world's most exclusive, high-stakes, underground poker game in the world. Get your copy on DVD and Blu-ray for a great, great price at deepdiscount.com. Listen, I just got Fletch, I just got Caddyshack, and Godfather. Amazing prices, classic movies. Look, click their logo on my website and check it out. Just go to paulmercurio.com. It's on the homepage. Be good to yourself. Buy your favorites, old and new. Watch what you want to watch when you want it. You deserve it. Thank you, Deep Discount. Hey, folks, welcome to this week's podcast. My guest with me today is Jay Paterno, son of Joe Paterno, legendary Penn State football coach. Jay has a book out now called Paterno Legacy, Enduring Lessons from the Life and Death of My Father. Jay, welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on.
Good to be here, Paul.
You played football under your father. That had to be... I had to work with my parents in the furniture business, and I was getting yelled at all the time. That's going to be tricky to play football under your father. What was that like?
Well, you know, it's I didn't play a whole lot in games. I was on the team and through practice and all that kind of stuff. But you know, like you said, you got yelled at all the time. Your parents expect a little more out of you than they probably did everyone else, and it was the same way with my dad.
Yeah.
But the other thing is, you know, when you play for your father, probably unlike the furniture business, when fellow teammates get mad at the boss, they can hit you. So, you know, I realized pretty early on there were a lot of guys in the team that at some point in their life would have liked to take a shot at my dad, and I was the next best thing. So I had to deal with that. And, you know, I expected some parental sympathy, and I got zipped.
Oh, really? Yeah, he played the whole, you got a tough love kind of thing, huh?
Well, the harder I hit, the more he laughed. I got hit, the more he laughed. So that was the kind of sympathy I got. He kind of enjoyed it.
Would the kids ever, like, say to you, hey, man, like, what's the story with your dad? Like, off to the side, go, can you talk to him? Can he, like, ease up? Whatever it was, I don't know. But did they ever come to you as try to be, like, the middleman?
No, not really. But, it was funny, like in my freshman year of college, I was out at a party in a weeknight, which, you know, you really shouldn't, you're not supposed to be when, you know, but I saw other guys in the team and a couple guys came over and said, Hey, Paterno, don't tell your old man that you saw us at this party. And I said, well, that got to be pretty stupid because then I'd be admitting I was at the party too. And then they kind of thought about it and said, oh, okay, good. Then we're all good here. I said, oh, don't worry. We're all good here. maybe not all good, but we're all in this together. So
Yeah. So they knew you were, you had to be on the right side of the conversation on that. Did you have any, like, I guess growing up, obviously with your dad being Joe Paterno, but just growing up in Pennsylvania, especially, you know, Penn State. Do you have any choice other than to play football as a young man? Like, did pretty much ever? Does everybody? Was there any thought of like playing any other sport, or were you just like, I gotta play because that's what you do here?
Well, my dad could do whatever you want, and I just love football from an early age. So really, it was probably not a, it wasn't necessarily a conscious choice, but it was definitely a subconscious choice, and that's what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
You know, when you're a 6 foot white guy who can't shoot, basketball is not really an option for you.
Right.
You know, and now I look at my kids and they're playing lacrosse and they're playing, you know, all these different sports that didn't even really exist. I mean, they existed, but they just weren't as mainstream. You know, so there weren't as many options in terms of sports then as there are now.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, football is something I gravitate towards, and I knew I wanted to coach at some point. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I headed that way.
So you mentioned you always said it had an eye or thought on coaching, and you did coach for 17 years, you know, under your dad, quarterback coach. And what was that like? I mean, what was the biggest adjustment in becoming a coach as opposed to being a player? Because obviously there's like, you got to know the X's and O's, so to speak, but you also got to be a motivator of people and know how to sort of, you know, get the best out of people. What was the biggest adjustment for you in doing that?
Well, I was fortunate because I left for 5 years before I came back. So I had kind of learned some things from other places and gotten a feel for things and kind of developed a style. It was kind of my own kind of style before I came back. So when I came back, having coached for 5 years, I was kind of ready to get in there. But and I think the biggest adjustment is that all of a sudden you have different responsibilities as you do as a player. You've got to motivate people. You've got to be someone who can also be able to teach people things. I mean, I think one of the biggest lessons I got was to be really good in coaching, you've got to be able to explain the same thing four or five different ways because everybody you coach learns things differently.
Yeah.
Some kids can learn, they can see the whole field. Some kids can learn point by point. So I think that was probably the biggest adjustment was just learning how to teach and coach to a lot of different types of people.
Yeah. And you, was it the kind of thing where you just thought, and then once you, again, working with your dad, it's sort of like there's good and bad, you know, when your dad's in the same business as you. But I mean, obviously there was a lot to learn from him. What were some of the biggest sort of things that you took away from his style of coaching?
Well, I think the thing about it is he always came back to the fact that in college football, you're dealing with young people's lives. Mm-hmm. And that you have to keep that in mind. It's not just about wins and losses, but you know, there should be a higher calling in college football besides just winning games.
Mm-hmm.
And that college football can be a kind of lesson to that end. And that he told me one time when we were walking home from a game that, you know, we got to remember that every kid that we coach is somebody's child. And they put a lot of time and effort into giving them to us. And that we had a responsibility to make sure that when they left Penn State, they'd be better people than when they got there. And, you know, if we happen to win enough games to keep coaching, then great. But, you know, that was our first and foremost responsibility. And I think that's an unusual lesson, something you don't hear enough anymore in college, in big time college sports.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely become about the business and, you know, kind of if someone gets injured, they move on to the next person or, you know, how important is their education and all of that is sometimes sort of secondary, unfortunately, because it's been sort of, it seems like, you know, I know your dad was a proponent of stipends for kids, but, I mean, where do you stand with that in terms of the amount of money that's made through NCAA, especially Division I sports? I mean, do you think that there should be a restructuring of the whole system so that kids are sort of provided some kind of income at least, especially a lot of these kids or a fair amount of them come from, you know, less than well-off parents, if you will.
Well, I think there's a happy medium. I mean, there's people that want to just flat out pay them. And I think that's a very dangerous thing because it changed the nature of what college football is about. But I think there should
be. But how would that change the nature of it? It's already about a tremendous amount of money. These schools are generating the Penn States of the world and you know, Nebraska, et cetera, generating literally hundreds of millions and billions of dollars for the school. So if someone gets paid, how does that change the nature of what's already happening?
Well, I think the thing that you have to be careful of is that we don't lose sight of what their goal is at a place like Penn State or a place like Nebraska. Yeah. One of the arguments I've always had with people about getting paid is when you look at, if you're an out-of-state student at Penn State, your scholarship is worth about $45,000, $50,000 a year right now.
Right.
The sport that they play in season, if they follow NCAA rules, which we did, in season they can only be with us 20 hours a week. And then the rest of the year, it was only 8 hours a week. So you really, there was a pretty good return on the hours they put in. However, I think there's no question there needed to be a stipend above and beyond the scholarship. And, you know, if I told, you know, I think the thing that gets lost in this is that they should get paid, and people forget there is an opportunity for them to get paid, and that in that they could be making a $35,000-$40,000 a year scholarship. The point is, if I went to most kids in college campus and said, would you like to play the sport that you love in front of 100,000 people for 20 hours a week in season, 8 hours a week out of season, and you leave college with zero debt, I think most kids would jump at that opportunity.
Right.
But I'm not naive. You know, there is money being made. And I think the coaches really have brought this on themselves a bunch, because they've accelerated the salaries so much. I mean, my dad retired in 2011 and was making, not retired, he fired at the end of 2011, was making $1 million a year, which to a lot of people sounds like a lot of money to coach football, but he was ninth or 10th in the Big Ten in salary. And when you look at, you know, there are dozens and dozens of guys that are making $2.5, $3, and $4 million a year coaching football. He was actually kind of on the low end of the schedule on the scale. But, you know, it was only 1994, the first guy, first public contract went over $1 million a year. And now we've got guys making six and seven.
So yeah, see, I think it's all, I think
the numbers are so big.
Yeah, well, I think it's all relative. Like, I think some people go, well, you know, if you're running a business that's generating, pick a number, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars for an institution, 50 million, 60 million, 100 million, whatever it might be, and direct revenue and related revenue or tangential revenue. I don't have a problem. I don't think anybody has a problem with the person that's mainly responsible for that, namely the head coach making $1 million. I mean, that's like a CEO making $1 million for a company that generates 60 million, 70, I don't pick a number of, I think where people sort of, the disconnect starts to come is, if you, what's the average life of an NFL football player? Average career is what, something like 3-4 years. So you can make an argument I don't know what the number is, but a huge percentage of college football players, even in Division I, do not go on to have any kind of a career in the NFL, right? Only a very small handful of people do that. And so that's essentially their career. Their football career is college, 4 years. So maybe for 4 years, you know, that's their chance to make some decent amount of money, not necessarily to retire, but to be stable, to provide their family with income. And so I think there's that sort of argument. But I don't know if it's ever going to change, because the NCAA is, you know, there's a lot of layers you got to go through to get people to see that argument, you know. But like for a lot of kids, this is their only career. And maybe they need to get more than even just a stipend. You know, I'm not saying they get a $40 million contract for 4 years either. You know what I mean? Somewhere in the middle, I think, maybe.
Yeah, and I think that's probably where this is headed. It's not going to be $100 a month, but it's not going to be $10,000 a month either.
Yeah.
And I think that's where the NCAA is going to be. You know, there are some schools that have floated out, you know, a scholarship plus $10,000 a year, which is probably a pretty good starting point. Where the rub is going to come in is, at a school like Penn State, we have 31 sports, and only three of them are profit centers. So you're really looking at, if you start giving football players, you know, whatever you get to football, because of Title IX, you're going to have to give to every athlete. So now you start to multiply $10,000 a year times 450, 500 athletes in scholarship. That starts to turn into a lot of money all at once, which, you know, I'm not, that's neither good nor bad. That's just the reality of the situation.
Yeah, but see, that's why Title IX.
People have to adjust.
Yeah, well, that's why Title IX. I was just going to say, I think Title IX needs to be changed too. You know what I mean? All of that was done at a time and a context where Title IX in theory is a great idea, but you know, you shouldn't have to give a field hockey player the same whose team is generating zero revenue for the school, the same amount of money that you have to give a football player who is. I mean, I think that the people, you know, it's life, you know, and you can recognize differences and reward people for their contribution without being perceived as having discriminated against somebody else. That I think the whole thought, not only the system, but the law has to change too, you know?
Well, I think it's one of those things. I don't think it was ever really intended to be applied to athletics when it was first passed.
Right.
It was a law saying that if you're the high institution of higher education receiving federal funding, you had to provide the same opportunities for women as you do for men, which I completely applaud. But it has been applied to athletics, and that's where, you know, that's where the rub comes in terms of, you know, if you do this for men's basketball, you have this women's basketball. And that's just kind of, that's the reality we work under right now and the reality we're going to be working under for the foreseeable future. So
yeah.
Obviously when you start to pay kids stipend, that's going to come into it. And you know, if you have to budget another $5 million or $500,000, whatever it is to give kids stipends, you know, coaches can get by on $4 million instead of $4.5 million. If you got to find
right.
a budget somewhere, you know, they'll find a way to make ends meet.
Right.
And that's what my dad used to always say, how much do you need? You know, if I'm
yes.
making $1 million a year, I don't need to go in and demand that I need $3 million because I want to be the highest paid guy in the league.
Right.
He used to laugh because you'd see guys' contracts that were written as such that if I win a national championship, I automatically am triggered to be the highest paid coach in the Big 12 or the SEC or whatever it is. And he said, that all works until the next guy, somebody else in your league wins the national championship. Now they get to bump up and now you have to get bumped up. He said, it's kind of silly. He said, if you got enough money, then shut up and do your job.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Hey, real quick, just to go back to your playing career at Penn State, you were a quarterback. So what is, you know, in big time college football, which is, you know, obviously the closest thing to the NFL, what is sort of the hardest thing about playing quarterback, you think, that people don't realize? Is it being able to read defenses on the fly and make adjustments on the fly? And how much latitude do you have in college football to do that?
Well, I think the biggest thing is having coach quarterback for 12 years. The hardest thing to do is in college, you have a lot of different defensive schemes. And while you're, you know, in the pros, that's all you do. And in college, you have to go to class and you have to write papers and you have to give presentations. And then you have to come in and kind of shift your gears. And now all of a sudden you have to put aside what you do in classwork and look at film, and teams are different each year and teams are different. There's different personnel, and you don't have the kind of time to give to it that you do in the NFL. So learning the game, the classroom work is very, very difficult. And the mental aspect of playing quarterback is tough, not just on the field, but when you have a great game, everybody wants to kiss your rear end.
And yeah.
when you have a bad game, all of a sudden, and now it's even worse because you have Twitter and you have social media and you have relatives that love to go on it when you win, and then they venture onto it when you lose, and they call you and say, can you believe these guys called you this or said this about you?
Yeah.
The pressure on these guys is so immense. I mean, I shudder to think what my what videos and photos would have been out there of me when I was in college.
I know.
I mean, that is something I would not have wanted in college. And I also know that, you know, I'm glad I didn't have a cell phone because, you know, your girlfriend could call you at any time and want to know exactly where you are. And, you know,
exactly.
you wanted your apartment. You say, look, I was out with my guys, some guys having hamburgers at McDonald's when, you know, you may have been trying to chase somebody else. So, I mean, we lived in a better time, I think.
No, I think so, too. There's stuff that I've done. There's, you know, me drinking way too much, and then my friends put me out on a lawn chair for the rest of the party and laughing at me. And, you know, if they had cell phones, there would have been a bunch of pictures of that existed for the rest of my life. You know, nobody carried cameras around with them, you know what I mean? But that's the thing too, is like, you know, you're in college, you're like 18, 19, 20, like we're older now. So we both know you're still like a kid, you're baby. The kids are having fun then. Like, were there any fun things that like just happened on the field or off the field, like as a player, as a coach in your time in college football that like really make you still laugh to this day? Like that are just like kind of, you know, fun classic stories, like anything funny or silly that kind of happened when you were either playing or coaching that stands out?
Well, I mean, there was always, you know, guys would play jokes on each other, and the camaraderie of the locker room was fun. You know, my dad had in 2001 set the record for most Division I wins, Division I A wins, and somebody had delivered this giant cake with blue and white icing all over it. And so, you know, the guys are, you know, you put free food in the college football locker room, it's not going to last very long. Well, the next day we're sitting in a meeting, and that afternoon we're sitting in a meeting, and you know, one of the guys gets up and he comes back from the bathroom and he doesn't look too good. I said, "What's the matter?" He goes, "Oh, you know, I was having some issues, and I looked in the toilet and my, you know,
your shit. You can swear on this. You're my shit. Looks like."
Yeah, he said it was blue and green and whatever, and the other guy started laughing. I said, "It's the icing," because like every guy's was panicking, like, "Oh my God, what's wrong with me?" And then another time, you know, one of the guys I coached came in and said, "Hey, can I get the tape from yesterday's practice? I want to look at it." Boom, we're still using tapes. He said, "I have to take from yesterday's practice because I want to look at it before we meet." So I said, "Sure." So he goes in about 40 minutes before we meet. When I come down to the meeting, I said, "Hey, where's practice tape?" And he said, "Oh, it's in the machine." So I talk about a couple things on the board, and we go over a couple things, and I sit down to turn on the practice tape to review what we've done, and lo and behold, it was not the practice tape. And without giving the specifics of what it was, let's just say I hit the stop button very, very quickly.
Nice.
Because they had, I said, "Okay, guys, you cannot do that." And they were laughing. The guys who kind of my tape back, I said, "Actually, no, I might take this home." But no, they took their tape back. That's the kind of stuff you like to do.
Yeah, well, that's good. Well, that's good, though. That's good camaraderie. And that's commitment to your team when you're shitting the school colors. That's commitment right there.
Absolutely. And it was just funny because you could see guys coming out of the bathroom, you know, later on, right before practice, and they just had this look on their face. And guys, it's the icing. Relax.
That's hilarious. So your dad, by the way, went to college in my hometown, Providence, Rhode Island. He went to Brown. I know there was some talk, and I've seen interviews that he's done and whatever, and read that he was thinking about becoming a lawyer, but then started coaching Rip Engel as an assistant coach at Penn State. So what was it about coaching? Was that something always sort of, you know, in his head to do, or like, why didn't he go the law route? Did he ever talk to you about that? I mean, what was that all about?
Well, he when he got out of Brown, I think he said he owed $2,000, and his dad didn't have it. And he said, "You know what? I'll go coach for a couple of years and then pay it back and then go to law school." And so he decided to go coach for a couple of money, and 61 years later, he still didn't go to law school. Right? He just fell in love with it. He just loved doing it. He loved being around it. And the comp, it could be, you know, my dad was one of those people that competed in everything. I mean, it didn't matter what we did.
He was super competitive guy. I mean, he played football too, right? Wasn't he a reserve quarterback also?
He started for Brown, and back then was playing offense and defense because they played both sides of the ball back then. Substitution for offense and defense. So he played both ways, but he just loved the competition. And, you know, when he got into coaching, you know, you win a big game, and literally within an hour or two, he's talking about the next one. When you just want to say, "Hey, can I just enjoy this like overnight at least?" But it was always the next challenge. It was always the next thing, and he always wanted to play the best team he could play. If there was a team out there somebody thought he was better than, he'd say, "I just want to get a shot at him, let them know that we, you know, see how good we are." He really enjoyed that part of the game and the competition, and you know, he loved, you know, I coached for guys that on game day they get all nervous and all 9 yards, and he loved game day. I mean, game day was it for him. That was, you know, as he said, he goes, "You know, we don't work 354 days a year so that the other 12 are boring, or that we should be afraid of them. We should be excited and looking forward to them." And he's exactly right.
Jay has written this book, Paternal Legacy, Enduring Lessons from the Life and Death of My Father. And, you know, in it, I think you want to give a full account of your dad. So obviously you wanted to kind of, you know, although a lot's been written about your father and he's very well known, you wanted people to know, I think, the full story of his life. And I was curious as to why, there's lots of different theories as to why guys like your father or the Bobby Bowdens of the world or whatever are so successful with that level of coaching. Because I think it's a little more challenging in some ways coaching college students than pros, because pros, you don't need to worry about if the kid's, you know, within his 20 hours, if he's getting his studies done and blah, blah, blah. You just, all you need to do is just make sure the guy's a good football player, because there's theoretically adults, although NFL behavior has proven that there aren't a lot of adults out there. But, and that's something I want to get to in a second. But why do you think your dad on the X's and O's side as a football coach, on that side of it, was so successful? Like, what was his secret and what was his methodology that he developed over time that, you know, you could point to?
Well, I think the big thing is he was adaptable. He adapted X and O wise. You know, if we had certain types of personnel, you know, he would adjust what we did on defense or adjust what we did on offense. He used to tell us, guys, it's not what we know, it's what they know. And it's not our system, it's the best system for them. So he adapted a lot of different times over the years that way. Also, he adapted how he dealt with people. I mean, when he first started out as a head coach in the 60s, you know, most of the teams in college were predominantly white from two-parent households and, you know, very stable that way. And over the years, you know, you had a lot more kids from single-parent homes, from disadvantaged backgrounds, and the demographics changed, much like this, the demographics of society at large. And he was smart enough to always ask questions. If he didn't know, you know, he was one of those guys. One of the really underappreciated hallmarks of great leadership is the ability to recognize that what you don't know and to seek the answers for what you don't know. And he always was asking, you know, he would always say, this kid, we just can't seem to get to him. Does anybody know how to scratch his bark? You know, what is it that's going to motivate him? And he would, you know, he'd bring kids in and sit them down and say, you know what, he'd find out about their background, find out about what was bugging them. You know, sometimes they had a situation where they're going through something with a parent that has cancer, or they have a girlfriend that's pregnant, you know, all these kind of things. And he would always have the ability to adapt and adjust to those ever-changing scenarios.
Was his strength defense, offense, special teams? Like, where was his, just every head coach sort of has an area of expertise. It's just, one part of football where they were sort of brought up or raised as a coach, if you will. What was his, just in terms of the actual, like, sort of, various, whether it's special teams or whatever it might be?
Well, I think the thing that was unique about him, and he's probably one of the last of a generation, is he could sit down and draw up defenses, draw up offenses, and be as good as anybody in the room with it. Mm-hmm. Because he constantly was, he used to always tell us, get the chalk last. And what that meant was, if you go up on the, when we had chalkboards, and so we all have a dry erase board now, but when you go up on the chalkboard and say, I want to run this play, and he'd go up and say, well, if you do this, they're going to adjust their defense this way. And you would say, yeah, but then we'd come back with this play if they adjust there. And he'd come back and say, yeah, but they're going to go and adjust this, and how are you going to adjust when they adjust? There was a constant chess thing with him.
Right.
He would always end up like, yeah, well, I get the chalk last, so I win because I'm the head coach. But he would say, our goal is to get the chalk last, anticipate their next move. So he was a guy that could do that both sides of the ball and was really, really good at it. And I think that was the thing that made him probably, he had real strength.
You ever try to tell him something when you were coaching under him and then he just looked at you like, shut up, you don't know what you're talking about? You ever have those moments where you start?
Not really.
No.
But you know, he used to say, boy, I can't wait till I get to be your age when I have all the answers. That's how he'd get me, you know. And I'd laugh and I'd say, I got you. You know, if you ever argued in the absolute something that was hypothetical, before a game, if you said, hey, if we start doing this, they will do this, I guarantee they're going to run this play at us or something like that. He'd say, you don't know that. But, you know, I hope I get to be like you someday where I have all the answers. But, you know, he was never that way. He would say, look, you know, I hear what you're saying, but you're wrong. And if you kept arguing, he'd say, look, I get paid to make decisions rather than I've made decisions. Yeah. On the flip side, if you talked him into something and then kept talking, he'd say, look, you made your sale, now, you know,
Move on.
you made the sale. Let's be good. No need to keep arguing. You convinced me. So, you know, he had that Brooklyn in him that never came out. You know, that bravado that he never lost.
Yeah. Well, being Italian myself, growing up in an Italian family, I know what that's like. Was there a game or games that, I mean, I know he's had some close ones and he's been upset, and were there games that always haunted him, you know, until his last day, like wish he could have back, or, you know, did he sort of make a move during a game that in retrospect wasn't the right move to do? There's got to be some. I mean, he's coached so many.
It'd be hard to pinpoint any particular one. Like, you know, he agonized over, not agonized, probably a little too strong a word, but, you know, he would always go back and evaluate every game. You know, when he lost, he would go back and say, geez, if I had done this. And he was the type of guy that always blamed himself before he blamed anybody else, which, again, is unusual in this day and age. You know, in this day and age, a lot of head coaches they turn and say, well, the offense didn't do this, didn't do that, and they put on the coordinator. He was always the first to blame himself. But even the unique thing about him was even when we won, you know, he used to always say, you know, you're never as good as you think you are when you win. You're never as bad as you think you are when you lose. And he would come in and say, hey, we won yesterday, but, you know, if we don't make this play, and this play, and we got away with this, you know, they made a mistake and they fumble here, otherwise we'd lose the game. So he would come back. He was actually harder on us when we won than when we lost. He'd come in with four or five or six or seven different plays where we made a mistake that could have cost us the game, but we got away with it. Mm-hmm. And he would point that out to us because he always felt like winning created complacency.
Yeah.
And he wanted us to have a sense of urgency all the time.
Well, you know, there were a couple of controversies surrounding a couple of games that some would argue kind of started the conversation about instant replay. I mean, there was a 2002 game against Iowa that you guys lost in overtime. And I guess Tony Johnson, you know, caught the ball with both feet in bounds, so it said, but they ruled it an incompletion. And, you know, your dad chased down the ref after the game. And then there was, you know, the Michigan game. And then later, I guess 2004 was when the Big Ten became the first conference to adopt some form of instant replay. And I was kind of surprised about that, only because your dad, you know, given his advanced age at the time, would be like old school, like, nah, you don't need instant replay. It is what it is, you know, kind of thing. There's a lot of those guys that sort of think that way. Were you surprised that ultimately came about, and you think like, and that your dad in some way kind of had something to do with that? I mean, do you remember that controversy?
Oh, absolutely. He was the driving force for instant replay in college because of those games. We lost to Iowa in 2002. Then we had a Michigan game in 2002. We lost, and then Ohio State. We had a really bad call that went against us. And his only argument wasn't about him. It was, you know, these guys that we coach put so much time in all year round. It shouldn't be decided by a mistake if we have the ability to correct the mistake. So it didn't surprise me that way. And it's turned out to be great, you know. And the NFL, the NFL already had it. And he said, look, every game's on TV. We've got the technology. You know, we're getting these TV guys have all these cameras and that kind of thing. So why don't we do it? And he really pushed and pushed and pushed. And we got it. And the next year in 2004, it actually helped us win a game or two. And then, it's been a great addition to college football, I think.
Yeah. What were his practices like? Just walk people through, for listeners who don't know what a big time college practice is like, and how involved the head coaches and your dad was in that process. And then what is also like, what is it like, game day in game? I mean, is he calling is he letting his offensive, coordinator call the plays, or is he sort of calling the plays through the offensive coordinator, and same thing at the defensive side?
Well, the practices, you know, we would come early in the morning, and he would meet with us, and he'd say, here's what we're going to do. And there'd be a certain top part of the practice set aside to work on the run game, and part of the practice set the pass game. And then we'd say, okay, let's get into situations, practice goal line, practice the red zone, practice in third down and long, third and medium, third and short, practice what we want to run first and second down. So we'd practice all different situations, and then we punt, return, all those kind of things. So you practice all those situations. And every day was a little different because you wouldn't do everything, every situation every day. But he would come in and he would have it down the minute. He would say, you know, from 3:58 to 4:15, I want to work on the red zone. And from 4:15 to 4:23, we're going to work on the screen game. And 4:23 to 4:35, we're going to work on red zone run, all those kind of stuff. So he would have it scripted literally down the minute. And then on game day, and during practice, you know, the assistant coach is really doing all the stuff that we're working on, and he would be all over the practice field.
Just roaming the field and kind of watching and just yelling out any notes that he had, or giving notes to the assistant coach. How far into it did he get?
Oh, he'd come in and say, hey, I didn't like the way he didn't block that right. Come back here and run it again. And he'd jump in and say, run that again. Don't let him get away with that. You know, if they practice bad habits out here, they're going to do it in the game. I mean, he would jump in and give little details. But you also see the overall scheme of what was going on. And he would say, and he'd come back, you know, the next day, he'd come back and say, hey, next morning, say, yesterday in practice, Jay, you guys ran this play in the red zone. I don't like it. Take it out. Too much of a possibility from the interception here. Come up with something else or do something different on third downs. And he would have a lot of notes. Or I don't like the first step the quarterback made on that particular play. Or the running back's not hitting the aiming point right. He would have all these notes. Mm-hmm. And then on game day, he would have both the offensive and defensive game plans with him. And then he'd let the coordinators kind of call. When he first started as head coach, he called every snap offense and defense. And nobody does that anymore. Nobody's done that in, probably since he did it back in the early 70s.
Why?
But he would come in and
why?
Because the game has gotten very, very complex. So, you know, there's so much stuff that I don't think anybody, one person could really oversee both of that and create the game plan. But on a game day, he'd come in and say, okay, if we want to run the ball, he'd come down and say, look, what you're doing is working. I want to call a couple here and there. And he'd jump in and call some plays offensively. And if he had success, he'd just kind of stay in it. He'd do the same thing on defense. Hey, look, you can't let the quarterback sit back there all day. I want you to start blitzing him. We got to go after him. So he'd come in and he had the ability to see the game. You know, one of the things he had the ability to do was really see how all the pieces fit together. Now, if the other team's offense was really, really good, he'd come in and say, look, we got to slow it down on offense, control the tempo, run time off the clock so they don't get as many shots on their offense against our defense. Or if our defense is really dominating, it changes to maybe we take a few more shots or a few more risks on offense because now their defense has control of the game. So he was able to really inject himself on both sides of the ball because he could see the whole thing probably better than anybody I've been around.
Mm-hmm. Well, he certainly built an amazing program, and obviously there was a controversy with the whole Jerry Sandusky situation. And, looking at it at the time and sort of thinking about it and thinking about it again and talking to you, like, do you think that, you talked earlier about how, you know, your dad would talk about, you know, these kids are given to us by their parents who brought them to this point and we have to take care of them. And I'm sure he believed that and did that. But do you think that, and a lot of people are familiar with the facts, and ultimately, you know, some responsibility was laid at your dad's feet for what happened or didn't happen. And do you think that the larger question for me on something like this is that the institution gets so big and the money becomes so important, and that people lose sight of what's important? You know, a person's stature becomes so big, and specifically your dad, where people are afraid to question that, and that contribute to some of what happened there, because obviously it didn't play out well for anybody, and a lot of blame can be pointed in a lot of different directions. Do you think some of that led to some of what happened?
Well, I think it's one of the most important things to note is that, you know, there's been a lot of misinformation out there, and ultimately, you know, my dad was made aware of one incident and he reported it to his superiors, because Jerry Sandusky at the time was no longer working for Penn State. He was a retired employee who had been given access to the building because he actually, when he retired, was a tenured professors. At one point, all the coaches at Penn State were tenured professors. So you get emeritus status, which means you have access to facilities, you have an office on campus, that kind of stuff. So when this was brought to attention, my dad, you know, by his own admission, said, I didn't know, I'd never had anything like this brought to me before. So he consulted university policy, which said you have to take it to the athletic director. Mm-hmm. And then the athletic director actually reported it outside the athletic department and outside the university. So the misinformation is out there that this was kind of covered up. It actually wasn't. In fact, the prosecutors in the case who had all the evidence that you know, Joe was forthcoming, honest, followed the law and was in no way involved in the attempt to cover up. And I think I think the thing is that, you know, these kind of crimes happen because there are people who have issues and have problems, and they commit the crimes. And I think the convenient thing is, for, as a society, for us, is to say, well, it's because of football, and that's what covers it up. And the reality is there are people like Jerry Sandusky in every community in America, and they operate in plain sight. And I think one of the things that's been an eye-opener for me is realizing that this happens all over the place, and that, you know, everybody thinks they need enablers, and, you know, we've worked. My family has worked with some people, Jim Clemente is one of them, who's a former FBI profile in this and also a sexual abuse survivor himself. And he said, Jay, these guys don't want enablers. They do everything they can to hide it from everybody. So I think that really kind of, that took on a, you know, and he had, and one of the things he said is it's important we don't blame this on footballer Joe Paterno, because that tells everybody else in America, well, this can't happen in my community because we don't have that situation.
Yeah.
So I think it's important that people understand that.
Yeah, no, and I think that's fair. But there was a there was some history that, you know, I don't think anybody would question the fact that more could have been done, right? In other words, you know, you have a guy walk in and see an older man fondling a boy, and I understand it went through the chain of command as it was supposed to. But it stopped there, and that was 2001. And in 98, there was an incident that the school was made aware of regarding Sandusky. And there's some conversation that your dad knew something about it. And that's, I guess, up for question. But the issue becomes like, and even your dad had the quote, I wish I had, you know, I could have done more. I wish I had done more. You know, I don't know that it's pointing at football as being a bad thing, but sort of institutionally, it seemed like there were people, and I don't know that your dad was necessarily this person, but there were people that kind of wanted this to just go away and was hoping it would just go away. And he also, like, you know, why was Jerry Sandusky, when there were these conversations surrounding him, is going back to 98 and even earlier, that he was allowed to continue to have access to any of the facilities under any circumstances. Because to me, and a lot of people, it's like, even if there's a slight hint of that, you walk, you run away from that as fast as you can, as far as you can, you know? And so, and I know that, you know, there's some feeling like, well, the free report wasn't necessarily thorough enough, or didn't do enough free analysis of all of the facts. So talk about sort of that aspect of it, and more could have been done, maybe should have been done, not that maybe necessarily just by your dad, but by others as well, and the free report and where you guys come out on that.
Right. I think it's important that one of the things that happened in 98 was it was given to the county district attorney, and the state of Pennsylvania was involved, and three psychiatrists interviewed both the victim and Jerry Sandusky, and two of them came away and said, there's nothing here. This situation where they were, you know, in a workout and showering. And I think the other thing that people have to understand is it's very easy to judge actions in 2001 based on what we know now in 2014. At that time, Jerry Sandusky was, I mean, you know, was a married, church-going, non-drinking football coach who had built a statewide charity helping kids. And, you know, people often see, well, you guys should have known he was all these things.
You know, things were sort of done technically according to the book. You know, that and even your dad's admission, you know, toward the end of it, that more could have been done. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think, you know, it's important that people realize that when you, you know, that you can't judge everybody's actions in 98 and 2001 based on what we know now. I mean, Jerry Sandusky at that time was, you know, considered a pillar of community, a guy who had started a statewide charity to help young people. Mm. But the 98 incident, it was reported to the county district attorney, the state of Pennsylvania investigated it, and three psychiatrists interviewed both Barry and the victim and came away with the idea that nothing criminal happened and nothing out of the ordinary or that was not right that happened. So, but that said, we were never made aware of that, even as fellow coaches on the staff, because that's the way the law is, because the law, you know, the thing about it is these types of crimes have to be investigated very delicately because there is an anonymity that has to be given to the accuser, but also you have to protect the rights of the accused as well, because certainly if any hint of something like that, even if it's a false accusation, certainly stays with people all their lives. And obviously we know a lot more about Jerry Sandusky now than we did then. But, you know, it was one of those things that was never brought to anybody's attention. It was investigated by the state, and they basically said, look, there's nothing here. So when 2001 rolled around, you know, certainly, you know, maybe the state should have done more in 98. Maybe the second mile where the charity Jerry had started, where this was reported to, and there were mandatory reporters there who had an obligation to go report to police. What they did with it has never really been investigated. So right. I'm sure there's something more that could have been done, but for whatever reason, whether the police and everybody had not really investigated why the reports that were given the second mile never really went anywhere.
Right.
I think there's no question more could have been done, but I think what more could have been done doesn't necessarily lie with Penn State. It really lies with the people who are mandatory reporters who are made aware of it.
Yeah.
Doesn't make it go away. It doesn't make anybody feel any better, but I think there's definitely some lessons that still have to be learned outside of Penn State as to how this was handled.
Yeah. Why in 2001, there was the incident and then there was some internal discussion among Curley, Schultz, and Spanier. Also, according to emails with your dad about, you know, possibly reporting this to the Department of Public Welfare, but then there was a decision to not do that. Why do you think that that ultimately didn't happen?
Well, nobody has established whether that's ultimately happened or not yet, which sounds strange, but there are still three trials that have to take place as it relate to Curley and Schultz and Spanier. And all those facts, I don't think have, because there have been reports that it was given to the Department of Public Welfare. It was certainly, we do know for a fact that it was reported to the second mile, who had an obligation to report it, as because that's where Jerry worked and that's where this child most likely came from. So there still is a some of that is still up in the air as it relates to Curley, Schultz, and Spanier and what the second mile did and whether it was reported to the Department of Public Welfare or not. So that error, that part of the story still is not completely established, and I think we'll find that out as these trials go forward eventually. And again, here we are 3 years later, and those three men still, having been charged over 3 years ago, still have no court date and no trial date, which
right.
is, you know, it's just an ongoing...
It's going to be a while, but I mean the free report, I don't think anybody's questioning those facts, that there was a conversation about going outside of the institution of Penn State to tell the authorities at the Department of Welfare. And then there was a decision not to, and that leaves, I don't think there's any question that those facts are facts. So the question becomes like, well, why wouldn't they have just had that conversation? And that starts to sort of beg the question, well, you know, because you want it to go away, you want to protect the institution. I don't know if that's the case, but sort of like, that's where, you know, everything you say is valid, right? Like, there are people out there, there are these predators out there, they're everywhere. It's not just in the world of football, but when it starts to sort of get very obvious, like there's a guy in a shower with a kid. I don't know about you, man, but the way I was raised, I tell everybody to the high heavens to cover my ass. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know where. And so sometimes what people have to remember is look at it from the average person sitting on their couch who's a sports fan or a member of society who has nothing, no skin in the game, and go, that doesn't make any sense. Why wouldn't you just start calling everybody and anybody, the prosecutor's office and everybody? And, you know, especially now there was already some conversation from 98 about this guy. And I think that in an unfair way hurt your dad. You know what I mean? Like, I think the institution hurt your dad in a way. You know what I mean? Because
I think the thing is that the institution, when they commissioned the Free Report, it was sold as an independent investigation.
Right.
What has come out in the last couple of weeks in because of some litigation is that this was not an independent investigation. In fact, they had a result that they wanted. So they literally interpreted things that were open interpretation into saying that this was covered up or concealed to protect the football program, which we now know that's not the case. We now know that it was reported outside the university. Now, the question is, you know, the question that has yet to be asked, because Free didn't have access to Curley, he didn't have access to Schultz, and didn't have access to Mike McQuarrie, who was the person who actually witnessed whatever happened in the shower that night. And I think it's important for people to realize that Jerry was actually, you know, convicted on 45 or 48 counts. The ones he was not actually convicted on were the ones from that night. So the public perception is that there was a rape involved there that night. There was not. In fact, he was not convicted of a rape. At that night. So even that is so no one's sure exactly what Mike McQuarrie and my dad and by his own testimony was intentionally vague. And in fact, there's even a question now as to when my dad was questioned by the Attorney General's office. They asked him what Mike said, and the transcript of the interview of the grand jury says my dad saying it was of a sexual nature, whereas there's a question as to whether the tape would say, was it of a sexual nature? I don't know what you would call it. Or did he say it was of a sexual nature? I don't know what you would call it. There are two very, very different answers there. But the most important.
Yeah, but hang on a second, Jay. See, the fact that you're having that conversation and like, is it, was it, or whatever, and parsing the words in the language like that, makes people feel like people lose sight that young people were really harmed, right? Like, so it starts
oh,
to start.
Hang on.
People have to be careful. Like, I understand that everybody wants to sort of, people want to protect sort of, you know, and people want the right information to come out, but in doing so, not look like they're sort of ignoring the bigger issue here too. You know what I mean? It's this bad. It's a tough balance.
But I think the point I was getting to is Joe then sent Mike McQuarrie on to talk to Tim Curley and Graham Spanier and Gary Schultz, excuse me.
Right.
And we don't know to this day what exactly was said there, because if they were told he was in the shower with a kid after a workout, that's much different than what was written in the presentment where, you know, the grand jury presentment said that that Mike McQuarrie witnessed the anal rape of a child, which was not true. He never said that, never testified to that.
Right.
And that's really what set off the firestorm, is people believed that Joe had been told about an anal rape of a 10-year-old boy in the showers of our building and simply did nothing about it. And that was the narrative that took off. And it was unfair to my dad.
Yeah, and it didn't.
But that said, young people were harmed. And my dad, that's why my dad said, with the benefit of hindsight, I wish I'd done more, because who wouldn't have wish they could have seen something sooner or been aware of something sooner to make this have stop a lot longer, you know, a lot before. And he, you know, like he said, this is an issue I was very, very unaware of and very, and had never dealt with before, because I'm dealing with 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, and 23 year old people. So I've never been trained in this to even know what it is. And that doesn't make it go away. And certainly take away the pain of it.
No,
you got to be fair to people in these situations.
Yeah, absolutely. You're right. Media can grab onto this stuff and start to create distortions as well. It's a very murky situation for a lot of people. But
I completely understand why people, when they heard the first things that were reported inaccurately, formed the opinions about this place and about Penn State and about my dad that they did. But as the facts have started to come out in this case, it started to turn, and people said, "Well, wait a minute. This wasn't what I thought initially." And it's not just this story. It's every story.
I think the media
world that we live in now is that it's more lucrative to be first reporting than to be right.
And you have to try and unwind
as much as you can.
Right. But you can't put it all on the media too. I mean, I definitely definitely think that everybody would agree, you know, across the board, more could have been done. And but there are a lot of people sort of wrapped up in this that have kind of, you know, have to kind of unravel some facts that aren't truly facts. And I know that that's part of what you're trying to do with the book and these conversations. And I respect that. So people should check out the book. It's a really good book, Paternal Legacy, Enduring Lessons from the Life and Death of My Father. And it talks about, you know, the legacy of Joe Paterno and, you know, really straight on addresses some of the stuff we were just talking about with the scandal at Penn State that, you know, was sort of overshadowed the end of his career there. But I, Jay, thanks for coming on. It was really interesting and great talking to you, and I really enjoyed having you on.
Thanks, hey, I really appreciate the time.